Hurricane Michael has left much of the Florida panhandle devastated. Is that the October surprise of this campaign season? Ron DeSantis' campaign adds another Duval piece, Lenny Curry's best op. In crime preoccupied city leaders, the big three blame the gangs. Council wants to talk it over. Also, a credit downgrade. These are some of the stories that's making headlines this week. Good morning, and thanks for listening. I'm A.G. Gankarski, and again from Melissa Ross, we are live from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect this Friday. Just ahead, we'll hear about a busy week in the news at our weekly media roundtable. Join us with your thoughts and questions, 549-2937. Then later, a local author shares her journey to sobriety. All of that's ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome the following all-stars. Radio host Angela Spears. Angela, hello.
Good morning.
Florida Times Union writer, Dangerous Dan Scanlon. Dan, how you doing?
Not that dangerous, but good morning.
Jack's Lookout editor, Sherry McGill.
Great. Thank you, AG.
And last but not least, Jacksonville Business Journal editor, Tim Gibbons. Tim, how you doing?
Not bad. Good to be here.
Good. Lead story of the week, it happened out west. It was Hurricane Michael. It made landfall near Mexico Beach early Wednesday afternoon, a Category 4 storm. The storm didn't affect our listening area in the way it did Panama City and Tallahassee, but it will bear an impact over the next month politically in the next 4 years, potentially. We're going to break it down a little for you today. Republicans ran ads throughout the storm prep period, reminding people of Andrew Gillum's Tallahassee, not allowing non-union workers to handle power restoration after Hermine in 2016. When I asked Ron DeSantis about those ads Wednesday, he said, "Now is not the time to discuss the campaign." Then he went on Fox News a few hours later and discussed the campaign. So let's start off with that race. Is Hurricane Michael going to change the race for governor? We want to get your calls, 549-2937. I want to start off with the panel. Dan Scanlon, you saw those ads. What do you make of those?
Well, first of all, I'm one of those that could not believe that there were ads being run about hurricane response during a hurricane. And those were obviously the DeSantis ads going against Gillum. And then just the fact that the governor himself in his ads is wearing the U.S. Navy cap that he usually only dons when he's doing his disaster coverage. And again, and he was all over Twitter. Every single minute there was something from Governor Scott talking about this response and that response. And there was an evil editorial cartoon that we had in the Times Union that shows his eyes swirling as he realizes that, you know, hurricane eyes, as he realizes that he's getting all this coverage during the hurricane, which I know is probably uncool, but I have to admit, I'm sure some of his people, having done political campaigns before, were probably very happy to see him on TV, constantly with EOCs, constantly in front, and all of his ads showing him on the front line handling hurricanes in the past.
And you know what I find, Dan, is very interesting, because I agree with you with everything you just said, that when you see those commercials of him showing leadership, oh, I had this hurricane, what does all that have to do with, you're running for the U.S. Senate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what does that have to do with that particular job? But yes, it was very, very disturbing to see those ads during this time when people were dying, that our state, parts of our state were, you know, was being destroyed. So it was just, it was very disturbing to see those. Those ads.
Yeah,
I do
agree
with you.
It's the benefit of incumbency sort of thing. I mean, yeah, he's not running for governor again, but you know, he's running on his record, and being able to do this does, you know, have a way he can connect with voters and say, look, I am the person who can step up and take charge, despite the fact that a typical senator does not obviously do that.
Yeah, and really, this is something I want to bring it back to the governor's race a little bit, because you know, DeSantis ran the ads against Gillum criticizing his storm response. So it was a very specific ad. And the context of that ad was that, you know, Gillum, while he's getting Tallahassee ready for his Category 4 storm, you know, he's having ads every ad break saying that he's not able to handle storm response. Was that fair, Tim?
Well, I mean, you know, everything's fair in love and war. I mean, what are you gonna do? Clearly, this was something DeSantis' team knew a hurricane was coming and had those ready. I'm curious if it actually resonates with kind of those, you know, whatever swing voters are left in Florida. The idea of only using union worker actually works pretty well for the progressive base. I mean, you know, in a different world, you can see, you know, actually that being something that Gillum champions, that look at what I did. So, you know, there is a, it will be interesting to see what the effect of them
and
are.
And give me a truth meter here. Did Gillum actually tell non-union utility crews, you cannot come into my city and do utility repairs during that hurricane?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the big question. And I mean, it's a more nuanced thing than that, because, you know, Gillum eventually relented and let people in. But mm-hmm. he also is a weak mayor of Tallahassee. He's not a strong mayor like Lenny Curry is here. You know, he's one commissioner who happens to be in the mayor's role. The city manager runs the city.
To explain from a, you know, political terminology standpoint, you're not saying that he is weak as a mayor. You're saying the system is a weak mayor system.
Right. Okay. Sherry, I want to bring you in here.
Good point.
You know, Sherry, you've got ads on the hurricane. You've got ads on, you know, the FBI probe that the Republican Party put out against Gillum. You know, what do you make of the politics of using a hurricane to drive up a candidate's negatives? Well,
clearly we're going to find out whether it works or not. Folks who live in the panhandle are not seeing these ads. I have a personal connection to Panama City Beach. I have family who live there, not been able to be in touch with them. So they're not seeing any of this. So I think it's a question of how it plays across the state. I spent a lot of time watching the Weather Channel over the last 3 days, and the optics there are fascinating. You see a governor who looks very staged.
Yes.
With his Navy cap on and a bunch of operatives around him. We've got this. We're a tough state. We know how to do this. Florida's no stranger to this. And then you have Mayor Gillum, very low-key, being interviewed by the Weather Channel, also wearing a ball cap, but it says FL on it. Florida, not Navy, very real, very human. He looks like a guy who understands his city, and it's a different kind of leadership presentation. I think I find those optics really, really fascinating. I don't know who's watching what.
I was, to piggyback on what you were saying, I was talking with some people who are fairly new to the state of Florida and living in Jacksonville, and that was the one thing they said. They were like, well, wow, those news conferences with the governor looked very staged, and this person was there, and everything was here, and everything was in place. And I said, well, that's how they're always done. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, because we've normalized it, so to speak, because we're so used to, he speaks here and says, you know what, you know, we can replace your home and your property, but not your life. You know, you're used to that. That even sounded robotic. You know, that even sounded robotic. And then the person too told me, well, it kind of bothered me as, you know, as a vet with that Navy hat. And he comes on with that. And then, you know, you're okay. Yeah. Sorry.
And I believe you were here for this one 4 years ago when the governor staged his grand opening second term, announcing he's running conference at a local business here in Jacksonville. And he had employees of the business behind him, all staged, waving Scott signs. Staged. They were managed to all be there for a news conference.
Oh, yeah, you're saying that like that's unusual.
The
manufactured news events go back to the 1930s.
But it's stage managed when the governor comes to town anyway. No matter what news conference he does.
But the point is, you want to be a little bit more relaxed when it's a storm, when something's happening, when there's a dangerous situation. You don't always have to have it so staged. It's okay to be natural.
I'm trying to imagine a relaxed Rick Scott.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here, because it cuts both ways. Going back to the governor's race for a second, you got Andrew Gillum in Tallahassee. Yesterday he did a photo op with a chainsaw, spent 45 minutes chainsawing trees. A camera crew from his campaign was there filming. A reporter asked and said, well, it's a public event. He has a right to film. But is Andrew Gillum guilty of using the storm to sort of burnish his reputation? Sherry, you're nodding.
Yeah, well, I think we see this all the time. We saw it locally with Irma. I think we see it all over Florida. I think we see it in every state that has horrible disasters. And we don't know whether the people tire of it or not. I do think it has the potential to make people deeply, deeply cynical.
Yes.
And we're cynical enough already.
I think that's a good point. But I think the idea of doing, you know, chainsawing trees and using that in a commercial is staged and is goofy and is the world in which we live. That's what politicians do. But there's always the issue that we don't elect people based on, you know, a technocratic sort of, you know, let me show you exactly what I did behind the scenes. That doesn't work very well for a commercial. So, yeah, they chainsaw down trees because that is the type of thing that works in the commercial, or at least has a potential of working. When, you know, a shot of the mayor sitting in an office just, you know, monitoring the situation in EOC, that's not good television.
Yeah, and 549-2937 for your calls. We've been talking about the Senate race a little bit already, but I want to work that in for real. Governor Scott has built his reputation for storm management. However, there are caveats. Y'all remember the nursing home deaths during Irma?
Of course.
May be deaths during this storm that that surface the next couple of days. But the governor has taken an interesting tack with this campaign. He decided basically to pause the debate that's supposed to happen next week on CNN. He said Governor Scott looks forward to debating, but will have no time for campaigning in the next few weeks as he focuses exclusively on recovery efforts for a foreseeable future. 549-2937 for your calls. But I want to talk about Scott's campaign strategy here. I mean, Sherry, that is a campaign strategy, right? To say, I'm focused on recovery, I'm not campaigning.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not sure that any of us understand what a governor does when it comes to relief and recovery and rebuilding. I've watched this for almost 30 years as a philanthropist, so I can't tell you what politicians do in this space. What's frustrating to me, simply as a citizen and a voter, is the power of incumbency and free media.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the amount of free media that the governor will get that his opponent will not get because he's the governor, and we're all paying attention to what the state of Florida is going to do, going to say about relief and recovery in the panhandle. That worries me.
It's not like he's running against somebody who's not in office. I mean, you know, Nelson, I think, has squandered times where he probably could have used that power of incumbency on his own. But frankly, I think that Scott saying let's postpone the debate was probably a canny move. The thing that politicians always fear is that luck of fiddling while Rome burns. And there is a value in basically saying, you know, no, I'm going to go in governor. And whatever that is, you know, I think as Sherry said, I'm pretty sure that there are people in emergency management who are actually doing the rebuilding and doing the, you know, the philanthropy side of things and actually, you know, helping people get on with their lives. Other than chainsawing down trees, politicians are not showing up to help you rebuild your house. But I think it's probably a better look than focusing on the politics.
But we can't get to a place where a politician hopes for a horrific hurricane a month before a major election. I mean, that's disastrous for the electoral process.
Well, I would never be cynical. Yeah. But
call me cynical.
Yes.
Cynical Dan.
Call me cynical, but I'm sure, having run campaign advertising in the past myself, albeit 30 plus years ago, somebody was pre-planning and going, you know, the worst time for the hurricane season is October. That's right before November. Let's plan some contingencies just in case. That said, there's no need for advertising. All you had to do was look at Twitter yesterday and you saw Governor Scott was there. TV stations and news media outlets were showing video of him on the helicopter tour. He was out there without even having to lift a finger. The news of the governor out and working and looking was there, for good or for bad. Reminds me of the days when Governor Graham used to do work days and the news media would shoot it, but I don't think anybody other than maybe one of his staff with a film camera was there to document it. It wasn't a create an event for a later ad. It was because Governor Graham wanted to get out there and meet people, and it looked good. It didn't look good for re-election purposes. It just looked good.
Yeah, and actually, you know, this one, I want to get your take on this, Angela, and then we're going to take a call. You know, Jeb Bush, when he was governor, he had 8 hurricanes within the span of less than 2 years. You know, and Jeb Bush has been kind of the gold standard, you know, for hurricane response. I mean, is Jeb Bush to blame for Rick Scott's posturing here?
Blame it on Jeb, huh? Blame it on Jeb. And you're right, it did start back then. But then I think it's some of the things that we've been talking about, how Rick Scott continues that with the Navy hat, as Dan mentioned, right? You're going out, yeah, doing these things, and you're showcasing that, and going back to the power of incumbency of, you know what, there are lots of things that Bill Nelson is out doing, but is the media covering that? No. They're, yeah, mainly showing, okay, because he's the governor, but then there are things that Bill Nelson is doing that, as the senator, he's a U.S. senator, that we're not doing. So, you know what, partly you ask the question, could Jeb Bush be to blame? Maybe so. Who knows? Maybe so.
Somebody's about to blame us. We got a call.
I know, right?
In.
They're going to blame me for blaming Jeb.
Carol from Keystone Heights, we're taking your call on First Coast Connect. Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that while I was sitting in my kitchen in lovely Keystone Heights enjoying breakfast, listening to First Coast Connect, I was really disgusted and very unhappy at the sounds of what the panels were saying. It was very petty. If you could all hear yourselves, I do believe you would be ashamed. Petty about talking about Governor Scott's election and Mr. Nelson's election and Ron DeSantis's. I can't believe that you are really that you really believe all those silly, petty things that you're saying. Isn't there something more important? I'm going to give up listening to First Coast Connect because of the continued bias. And that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you for your call. So, does Carol have a point? Are we being petty when we're discussing the politics of hurricane recovery?
No. And actually, I actually believe pretty firmly in this. So clearly, there is a timing sort of thing. And 2 days ago, you know, maybe this would not have been the appropriate response. But on this sort of show where we are looking at very important statewide elections, you know, this isn't horse race coverage. This is saying, how are people going to make a decision? Are politicians doing the job they're supposed to be doing? I actually think that examining how elections take place does have a certain value. And sure, should we examine, is the state doing the best thing to deal with hurricanes? Yes, that should also be a conversation. I think those conversations are happening. I think we have conversations about climate change causing more hurricanes. But I think this is one of the important things that voters in the state have to consider, because they're being bombarded with these images and deconstructing them is actually valuable.
Yeah, and H.E., I would say the way I heard your question was, are both parties and both candidates exploiting this horrific humanitarian crisis in the panhandle for political purposes? I think that's a fair question. Yep. You didn't ask us another question about, you know, relief, what's happening over there to the people who live there. But I think it's a fair question. We see it every day.
Yeah, I mean,
in social media and on television.
So, you know, Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, used to work for Bill Clinton, said, never let a crisis go to waste. And it's hard not to look at these things, you know, like hurricanes and storms, as crises that politicians often message off of. I mean, that was what we were getting at earlier in the program. I'm sorry that the caller was unhappy. We've got a couple more callers coming. You know, Brian's on the line from Beaches and Hodges. Brian, let's talk about the storm. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is, do we know what Andrew Gillum and Senator Bill Nelson were doing during the hurricane? I mean, I heard the woman call and criticize on you guys, but I didn't really know what else was happening. So I was wondering if you guys could comment on that. Thank you.
Will do. Thank you. So let's talk about that. Gillum, obviously, is running to save Tallahassee. We saw him on the Weather Channel. We saw him in various things doing interviews, but he was doing a lot of storm recovery. Bill Nelson, who wants to cover that one? I mean, you know, Bill Nelson obviously flew in after a storm. He's actually in the panhandle right now looking at things, but it's kind of a different role for a senator than a city mayor.
There was a statement issued from his office toward the end of the storm day regarding the storm. That's all I can remember of any coverage about him. I certainly remember seeing Gillum, tweets about Gillum, yes, and looking at media that he was out playing the role of mayor, which is what a politician should do. As to that first caller, we are not minimizing what happened out in the panhandle. If anything, we're talking about the fact as journalists that the campaign continued and seem to ignore or exacerbate the issue of the hurricane, forgetting the tragedy, forgetting the damage, to talk about little petty infighting here. It should have been suspended. We should have been seeing ads or public service announcements for initial fundraising, initial supplies being sent, what the TV newscasters were doing here, talking about emergency response.
And I'm not sure what Senator Nelson was doing, but we do know that the Senate just recently passed where they were able to leave, right? Because they weren't able to leave to come to their states to even to campaign. I'm not talking about the hurricane, but just to even campaign. So now they've been able to leave. So I don't know where he was during that time.
You also have the issue with the governor and the mayor that, you know, they're executives. They are supposed to be doing something.
Yeah.
I'm not going to blame any legislator for legislating. I mean, that a senator is right. Yeah. A senator is not the guy leading the fight. Now, does that, from an optic standpoint, look better for the governor in his race for Senate? I guess. I don't know.
Well, but you know, it's interesting. I saw multiple interviews with Senator Rubio. I didn't see any interviews with Senator Nelson. Why that's the case, I can't tell you.
That's what I was bringing up, because that you see, they don't interview him. They don't talk with him.
Yeah, I mean, part of the narrative of that campaign, too, is that Nelson is too tired to be senator for another term. He's 75, 76 years old. He's kind of in that last campaign mode, you know, and that's a lot of the Rick Scott narrative, is that Bill Nelson's not active enough to, you know.
Aren't there a lot of older gentlemen sitting in the Senate that we just saw on the...
Okay. And their staffers run the office.
Okay, I'm just saying, I just saw them a few weeks ago when we had the Kavanaugh hearing. I don't know. That's just me. You just saw older gentlemen.
Yeah, you know, an interesting point, AG, is we have chief executives in this region who have a film crew, who have a cameraman shooting photos, shooting video of their appearances. I don't know if that's for anything more than being social media later, but... certainly, when we're at a news conference, we are not the only people with cameras now.
Yeah, that's a good point. This is an excellent segue, because we got more campaign stuff to discuss. A big ad for Ron DeSantis' campaign. Tim Baker, Mayor Curry's chief operative, joined the campaign. That follows up on Susie Wiles becoming the campaign manager. Susie Wiles, a City Hall hand of long standing, a lobbyist, helped to sell the pension reform referendum. Baker said the campaign is starting to hit stride. You know, basically what Baker does in campaigns over and over again is he targets median propensity voters, female voters between ages of 35 and 46, gets them off of the fence and toward the candidate. And, you know, Baker sees it, the role is defining Gillum as a traditional major party candidate. We've looked at this race a lot on this program, not with this particular panel, but you can... can Ron DeSantis close the gap? I mean, Andrew Gillum's been up in poll after poll. You know, Gillum's got you know, sort of a buzz behind him. DeSantis does not. But will these operatives help him close the gap? Sherry, I'm looking at you.
Well, I mean, I think we've been surprised nationally around polling, and it's all turnout. So if you can get the voters to come out and vote for your candidate, you're going to win this race.
Yeah.
I think that if any of us knew that for sure, we'd be in Vegas right now. There are obviously, in some ways, you could look at the moves by the DeSantis campaign as acts of desperation might be too strong of a term, but it clearly is the ship needed righting. So you bring on people like Wiles and Baker because stuff ain't working, and there are people who have a track record of making stuff work. Now, I will say DeSantis, you know, emerged from a bruising primary. DeSantis won because of Fox News. So I don't know if that's actually an accurate way of describing that.
Okay, we got a bunch of callers on hold. I want to take some of them. Mark from the South Side, you're on First Coast Connect. Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that y'all keep mentioning that Nelson hasn't been featured, but he had a good 5 or 10 minutes on the PBS national news program last night. So you guys must not be paying attention to your own news program. But he was Woodruff interviewed him, and he went on for a good 5 or 10 minutes. Didn't tell us any additional news that we haven't heard already about the hurricane and the damage. But he certainly got airtime.
Did he seem like he was on top of the situation to you, Mark?
On top of it?
Yeah.
I mean, he really didn't tell us any more. I mean, you know, he's looking and saying, hey, it's all, you know, look at all this devastation, whatever. But he wasn't doing anything actively to help the situation at this point. But, what can you do other than you're getting your moment, you know, on national TV?
Right on. Thanks.
But he got his airtime. You guys kept saying that everybody else was getting there, like the governor, but he got his airtime and he got it on national TV.
Well, I think there's, you know, there's viewer demographics, and PBS, NPR, I think the demographic is a pretty small part of the voting population.
And you know, AG,
point.
Yeah.
The bottom line is, and I've heard this from many survivors, the one thing they don't want is a candidate or a politician
coming in
with a swarm coming in while they're trying to clear up and recover from this. They want help that stays. They don't want a political circus. And that's what a media conference would be if it was plucked in the middle of Panama Beach.
I think we might have a caller that agrees with you, Dan, here. Bonnie from Jack's Beach on First Coast Connect. Welcome.
Thank you for taking the call. I just want to say that I really don't think you're minimizing an issue. I think it speaks to a broader issue in our culture when politicians attempt to manipulate us by, you know, taking advantage of a catastrophe like the one that happened with Hurricane Michael. I think it happens all the time, and I think it's one reason why we as voters have to stay cued into what they're really doing to help us, not what they're doing in photo ops. I mean, my mind continually goes back to the photo op that where Governor Scott did a quick fly-in after the shooting at the landing, and he posed with Lenny Curry smiling with his thumbs up beside the dead of one of the victims. He did that while there were bodies in the morgue and people mourning. And I think the smile by a victim while people are in mourning just shows an insensitivity that really demonstrates their willingness to abuse a situation for their own gain. The other thing I will say about Bill Nelson, he was interviewed shortly, I believe it was CNN, and he said his job there, and he clearly made the point that he was there to survey the damage, determine what was needed in order and recovery for the coast, and to go back to Washington and make sure they got what they needed. But that was his role there, and that's what he was doing. So he may not have been taking a photo op with his sleeves rolled up moving debris, but he's there doing what we expect him to do as a senator.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, thank you, Bonnie.
I think Bonnie's observation about how she reports Nelson's response and his activity might be a huge change in how we practice American politics. An older politician, seasoned, whether he's exploiting it or not, I wouldn't pretend to say, but the observation is, here's my job. I'm going back to Washington to see what I can deliver for the people of Florida.
Isn't that his role? We've been talking about the roles of, we've been talking about what's a governor supposed to do, what's a mayor supposed to do, and what is a U.S. senator supposed to do? You know, is that was his role, right? To do that, to saying, hey, take it back to Washington. Here's what we need in Florida to let his colleagues know this is what we need here in our state.
And that's why the issue of those nursing home deaths, I think, is actually important, because if you look at the doing of the job bit, that's not the photo op. It's actually, the safety and security of citizens. And, if nursing homes are having people die in them, arguably because of state non-action, that's more of a condemning thing than, being able to stand up in an EOC.
Hey, Dan, I wanted to come back to you because I saw you nodding during the call when the caller mentioned the photo op / news conference after the landing shootings.
Well, I will tell you that victim was the most grievously injured of the 13 who were injured, because as a gamer, to be shot in the hand, right through, damaging two fingers, because we talked to the mother afterward. That means his job, his career, I know you can minimize it's a gamer, but that's what his job was. And now the question is, can he return? And the mother had a news conference, and I haven't seen a news conference like this in forever, at UF Shands, Jacksonville, with 27 journalists from around the country. And she held on very well about how her son was doing. But yes, that photo had been popped earlier with everybody smiling. And then later we find out he wasn't that happy.
No, and really, this is something, Sherry, I want to bring you in on this too, because, when the mayor was posing, mayor and the governor, but the mayor was smiling broadly, and you saw that tweet, everybody at this table saw that tweet. Was that tweet appropriate?
Well, I'll say it was political.
Yeah. Political how? Go
was
ahead.
Was it politically appropriate? I think it probably depends on your perspective. So if we're talking about politics, is it effective? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that we're going to keep coming back to, because the crime issue is something that we talk about time and time again on this program. We're about to talk about it again now. Jacksonville city leaders, Mayor Curry, Sheriff Williams, State Attorney Melissa Nelson, they did interviews with friendly media outlets this week. One of them was WJXT. They gave some quotes talking about the gang issue. Curry said, where it's happening is largely gangs regarding the street violence. We are working and collaborating together to solve it. Sheriff Williams said, you have about 1% of our population, maybe 800 people whose names we know, by the way, who are involved in these kinds of activities. Dan, you cover this stuff every day.
I put my head down every morning and it never comes back up. I never surface because of the amount of crime in not just Jacksonville, but what we're experiencing in Northeast Florida. Clay County was a place this week where a lot of nasty things happened, including what appears to be a serial bank robber, not just grandma or grandpa who needed lunch money. This guy was sentenced in 2010 for hitting banks across the Southeast, and now it looks like he's back out there again. Yeah, I mean, I've heard this from the sheriff before, and the sheriff's office does have a gang initiative where they're trying to reach out to gang members to stop them from going any further in their life, and telling them that if they do step over the line, we will be there to get you, and they do arrest them. But I will tell you that the majority of the shootings that we get on our emergency alerts are exactly as the sheriff says. They are gang-related. They are gangs masquerading as music studios, as rap groups, and they get annoyed at each other, and they take the battle to the streets. I just wrote up yesterday, a 15-year-old boy shot in the back of the head on the west side because he was asked where, if he knew where some weed was as he was walking with his older brother. He said, no, I don't do that stuff, and was attacked and then shot.
Wow.
Now, gang or not, that makes you stop in your tracks.
Right, but I was going to say that is different than I think what people perceive when they hear it's gang-related. I think we probably still have some, you know, decades-old view in our minds of what gang violence
is. Like a 1970 sitcom gang.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that type of thing is obviously an area where violence is prevalent, but I wouldn't call that, you know, traditionally gang-related. But one of the more important things I think that came up in even the interviews that they gave is this idea of we have to deal with the children. And I think that is one of the areas where Jacksonville has failed. If you go back and look at something like the Jacksonville Journey, the entire point of it was you get these kids, you get them at a young age, and you change the trajectory of their life, but the results aren't going to show up immediately. And as a city, maybe as a country, we're not good with this idea of invest in children now to solve a crime problem 20 years from now, but that's really what I think needs to be done.
All right, we got a caller on hold that wants to talk about investments here. He's been on hold for a long time, and I waited to get to him till now. Stanley P. Scott called in. Stanley, you're on First Coast Connect. Go ahead and tell us what's on your mind.
Good morning. Yes, my main concern, I agree with the lady first caller. Some empathy is definitely needed, and the governor and the senator need to back out the way and let the first responders do what they need to do as far as helping people. My main concern is that the city of Jacksonville is expecting for underserved grassroots leaders to save the city when the JSO has $400 million and they are not able to decrease crime, and it's been going over 10 years. And my main concern here is that the city of Jacksonville has no empathy for decreasing crime. They keep putting the issue on one side of the town when it's a city situation here when it comes to crime. But when it comes to having community grassroots leaders involved, the leadership keep the doors closed when they have meetings with the leadership.
Right on.
I mean, with the grassroots leadership.
Thanks, Stanley. Thanks. We're going to take another call. Willie from Murray Hill. Murray Hill, Willie, you want to talk about gangs? Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm enjoying your conversation. This sheriff, I think the fella's incompetent, and I voted for him and the mayor. But touching on what the fella before me just said, you're trying to say, you know, crime is on one side of town, and if they would put more money, like you say, $400 million in the disadvantaged side of town and the education system, you wouldn't have a lot of this crime. You know, you give people hope. These kids are dealing with hopelessness. But I'm just trying to say why, you know, it's easy, especially in a town like Jacksonville, you know, where it's still got some serious racial problems, to paint for, especially around voting time, to use the thing that it's the black people on the black side of town, when really you're not doing your job. That's the bottom line. You're not doing your job. When we get somebody in there can do the job, 21st century thinking type of person, you know?
Right on.
Then we can get something done.
Hey, thank you, Willie. I appreciate your call. You know, Tim, Angela, I want to get you in on this because, Tim, you covered City Hall during the Alvin Brown years. You dealt with that office. And the big criticism of Brown, one of them at least, was crime. Mm-hmm. He wasn't solving the crime issue. We're 3 years out from Alvin Brown. The bodies are still piling up in the streets. They're still talking about street gangs. You've got, you know, Williams, you got Nelson. They're all part of the same generation, and yet we're not seeing movement. Well, could this hurt these people running for re-election?
Yeah, danger of going back to that issue of, you know, looking at this all through a political lens. There is an irony of the idea that Curry did run against Brown saying, you know, you didn't solve public safety, and now you have, again, the same problem. I honestly have always found this strange as a reporter who's covered a lot of things that mayors run on public safety and education, but we have an elected sheriff and we have an elected school board. To me, it's somewhat baffling that we pick our mayor because they're going to fix crime and education when that's the two things that are not in their bailiwick. So,
yeah, and this is a quote I wanted to highlight from Lenny Curry. Why don't you get your take on this, Angela? Lenny Curry said, who are the young people, the 5, 6, 7, 8-year-olds who are exposed to this gang culture? Because if we don't get to them, they are next. We've got a gang member that's bad and needs to be arrested and prosecuted. There's likely a child 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old that is being and has been exposed to that. One of the discussions throughout campaigns has been this lost generation of kids, lost to gangs. Is Curry basically saying there that he doesn't have a solution to it, or is he saying the solution is going to take time to unfold? And if so, how much time?
I don't know what was in his mindset with it, but what I can tell you with talking with people in the community is that, you know, people feel that our kids need more activities. When you mention, okay, there are things for them to do besides sports, you know, you have many grassroots organizations that have activities. You know, I'm just going to name off, like, Don't Miss a Beat. They have right. things where you're tutoring, you're doing things that people want more activities. And that's where I think we need to focus on getting back into the communities, having things, also going back to the law enforcement issue with, you know, Tim, you and I have talked about this before, of having coming up with different strategies that law enforcement can do, you know, with engaging people, right? Making them feel that we can trust them. And why not have some of your top leaders sometimes get out there and patrol? I understand that they have things to do. You know, they have to, you know, plan out everything. You know, your chiefs, your directors, they have to plan everything. But how about them coming sometimes out in the streets, working a patrol shift, kind of getting out there and doing things? So maybe we do look at that different approach to how we're doing things, and especially getting our kids involved. Going back to what you were saying with getting these 4, 5, 6, 7-year-olds, we have to invest in them young.
Right,
we really do. We have to start investing in our kids, and we can't forget about our high school kids, because I think a lot of times we do things for children and then there's nothing for the high school kids, so we can't forget about them either.
Well, look at the high school age kids who have been suspects and who have been killed recently. Take a look at the 7-year-old who was killed on the west side in the middle of a gun battle among two other people. Take a look at the Raines High School shooting, because I was there that night and that morning, and I saw the grieved faces of the relatives, and I saw the response of the school board and the superintendent, welcome to the job, ma'am, when we found out it was gang-related as well. And we're looking at the ages, 15, 14, 16, 17. And they're looking at that age, they look up to their nearest successful person. And unfortunately, as the sheriff and mayor pointed out during that meeting this week, that is usually the person that makes the most out of crime.
Well, I think getting involved in things is important, but this might be speaking as a Business Journal editor, but they also need economic development. I think that economic development and education are probably the two things that those areas are most in need of, because that's how you change someone's life.
Yeah. There are not all bad things happening on the north side. Right. I mentioned this before, Northwest Jacksonville Community Development Corporation. That's just one organization that's doing things to bring jobs back into the community. Having more, you know, there's a new pharmacy, there's a new dentist, new having jobs come into your area where you live. Tim, to go further on your point, if people can work in their neighborhood, right? They invest in their neighborhood. They believe in their neighborhood. They want to make it better. So you're right. Economic development is a big part of it. And we all have to see that no matter what side of town we live on, it's all our investment because it's our city.
There is proof that is working, because Springfield used to be the bad place to be. And now take a look. There's microbreweries. There's restaurants. There are
homes being developed. Because people invested.
Now, it took 20 years. Ask us old timers.
Guys, we've got a lot of people on hold. I want to take a couple calls. Bailey from downtown, go ahead in 30 seconds. Tell us what's on your mind.
Yes, it's actually Dale from downtown.
Okay, thank you.
I just wanted to remind folks that, you know, to elaborate further on what you guys were just talking about, that Mayor Curry ran on the platform that, you know, Jacksonville was a war zone. Their crime was rampant. He ran as a political outsider, which he absolutely was not. But, you know, now that you have the big chair, and with Sheriff Williams as well, we had John Rutherford for the last
10 seconds.
He sat on his hands, basically. So now you have the right chair. Why can't you right the ship?
Right. What's on. Going on? Thank you, sir. Mark from St. Augustine has been on hold for a while. Mark from St. Augustine, go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I solving the crime problem is obviously a multifaceted approach. And one area where I haven't heard your guest speak, and that is the reluctance, it seems, on the people in the communities that are directly impacted you can stick a different word in here, to rat out, snitch, or help the police, because I know in many instances they have to know who committed these crimes, but it just seems there's a big reluctance on the part of the local citizenry to, again, for lack of a better word, rat those people out.
Yeah,
what's your thoughts
on? So, I think, you know, our callers are right. The panelists are right. It's multifaceted. It's complicated. It requires a sophisticated, complicated response that's comprehensive. I've, you know, watched this community for 3 decades now. In the 90s, we brought something to town called the National Council on Crime and Delinquency to address serious crimes by chronic juvenile offenders. That work had great success, and then it was defunded. Then we did Journey, defunded. Mm. So when Tim talks about the funding, I'm looking at 10 years of funding for children's services by city council, and it actually declines over time. The amount is the same today as it was in fiscal year 2009.
Would a mayoral candidate perhaps run for office on that?
It's the same amount as it was in 2009 when you factor in the inflationary factor. We, you know, $73 million in 2009 is worth about $60 million today. So we're defunding, not investing. And when the panel talks about what Paul Tutwiler is doing with Northwest JACS, what LISC is doing in Springfield, I've been intimately involved in that work. It's 2 decades of work, but I'll promise you that the political class here and the business class here does not understand what works and why it works. And on trust, all the research shows that when you break trust between the police and a neighborhood, it's impossible for people to come forward because there's no trust. They have no good reason from their perspective to engage.
Hey, we've got a segue here because we're 2 minutes from a hard break. So we could go on for another hour. We're about to go into early in Florida. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Only in Florida, this one man driving a Porsche hit 18 cars. Check Dan's pulse. residents of a Central Florida apartment complex describe a drunk driver's crash as a one-man demolition derby. 42-year-old Brandon Spaulding went through a parking space over a curb and then hit 18 cars. One resident said he came up right next to our bedroom window. There are tire tracks and the plants, radiator fluid on the sidewalk. Thoughts and prayers for Porsche. Eventually, the car was blocked. I want to give thank you for our panel. Sherry McGill, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Dan Scanlon, Angela Spears, and Tim Gibbons.
Thank you.
Happy Friday. Thank you.
Yes. We're going to be back in a moment with ticket giveaway. Stay tuned if you like orchestra music. I do.
Thank you.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Florida law requires drivers to give at least a 3-foot clearance when passing bicyclists. A violation means a traffic fine and license points.
Learn more at waynehogan.law. Mayo Clinic, where cancer specialists work together to translate new developments in cancer treatment into comprehensive, individualized patient care. More at mayoclinic.org/Florida.
A whole lot of companies have had a whole lot of trouble trying to navigate all those tariffs.
We've seen a flurry of phone calls, emails, people reaching out to us, really in many cases in panic, trying to figure out what they can do to mitigate the effects of these new tariffs.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Business during a trade war is booming for trade consultants. That is next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
They have big brains, they talk, and they've been up to space and back. I'm Ira Flatto. On Science Friday, primatologist Anita Stone decodes the chatter of our tree-dwelling cousins, the squirrel monkeys. And yes, she is fluent in squirrel monkey. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On Fridays, we welcome you to comment on the world as you see it, not just as you want it to be. Has Saudi Arabia killed one of its own for doing just that?
I am just a writer. I want a free environment to write and speak my mind.
Jamal Khashoggi disappears. Also, women in Brazil say, not him, and Bollywood meets Me Too. Next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Back. It's time to give away some tickets and orchestra lovers. We are looking at you. We have four pairs of tickets. Tonight's opener of the St. Augustine Orchestra's 57th season, Dvorak, Rossini, Sibelius, that's all on the bill. The concert is in the swimming pool of the Leitner Museum, happening tonight at 8 p.m. And if you want to be there, email us now at firstcoastconnect, all one word, at wjct.org. Put tickets in the subject line and tell us your name. We'll email you back if you're one of the winners. Hopefully you'll win. And finally this hour, she's the lovable local personality known to all as Tracy.com.
His words, not mine.
Tracy Collins has appeared on local television covering events for years, always with a smile and bubbly personality. You've seen her covering many events around town for many media outlets over the years. But behind the packed social calendar, Tracy was dealing with a problem she kept hidden, one affecting millions of Americans, alcoholism. Tracy shares that journey in her book, Stumbling in Sobriety. It's available on Amazon. It's available at some local outlets. We're going to discuss that. Tracy, welcome to the program. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fantastic.
And go ahead and tell us where your books are available real quick besides Amazon.
Sure. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at San Marco Bookstore. And you can get it at Gotta Have It in Avondale.
Right on. So, you know, your book, it's really, I looked at it earlier today. It's got some really important stuff in it. I mean, you've been in media for a long time. And, you know, through a lot of that time, you obviously dealt with issues relating to alcohol, correct?
That is correct. I read in the book how I kind of knew I had a problem as a teenager. But, of course, as it developed and progressed in my body, it got worse and worse. And then what ended up happening, what I kind of realized was the breaking point was I left media to take a regular job, as we like to call it.
Yes.
And with regular hours, I had a huge pay increase. So now I not only had extra cash in my pocket, but I also had extra time on my hands. And so things got really crazy the last 4 years.
So, you know, alcohol became like a coping mechanism, basically.
Yeah, it just became my best friend.
Yeah, and when you're dealing with that, I mean, it's sort of a safety valve. I mean, you mentioned, you know, when you're a child or when you're younger, basically developing the habit.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think spurred it? I mean, because obviously when people, you know, gravitate toward addiction, there's usually a catalyst.
Well, I can tell you that my mom has admitted since that she was a binge drinker, meaning that she once she started, she couldn't stop, which is where I was at. But she wouldn't then crave it the next day like I did. So as long as she stayed away from it, it wasn't an issue. And she doesn't drink anymore. So you always have the genetics involved. But there is something in our brains that for some of us, when alcohol gets into our system, it sends a message to our brain that says more, more, more.
Right.
And I fully believe that I have that that situation just because it was, you know, almost immediately my go-to thing as a teenager. And so that's the message of the book. My goal is to stomp shame and squelch stigmas. Because a lot of people, myself included, wouldn't ask for help because of the stigmas attached to alcoholism. I heard a TEDx talk where they said, if you tell someone I quit smoking, everybody says, oh my gosh, good for you. If you tell somebody I quit drinking, they look at you like, oh, what's wrong with you? And so I really want this book to get across that alcoholism is just like any other disease. If you had breast cancer, you would go see a specialist. If you had diabetes, you would take insulin. This is just another situation where you do not have control over it. It's okay. Go get help.
Yeah. And you know, obviously friends were helpful to you along the way. When I was reading your book, I couldn't go a paragraph without a friend. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, without those people, you wouldn't be here today, would you?
Oh, heavens, no, no. And the majority of them didn't even know what was going on. I was very masterful at hiding it. So, that's also in there. And what I've noticed is that people who can relate to what I'm talking about, that makes them understand what they're going through. So when I'm explaining like the ways I hid the alcoholism, I've had people reach out to me and say, oh my gosh, I cannot believe I totally saw myself in you and realized that I needed to get help. Because when you're in it, you feel like you're the only one doing exactly what you're doing. And then when you realize we're all really the same, meaning all of us as alcoholics, then you feel like you have some kind of camaraderie.
Yeah.
And the other thing was, I was this professional going on television every morning, and I was able to cover it up with makeup and hairspray. And so I felt like, I bet there's somebody out there who can totally relate to this and will get something out of this.
Yeah, your book, Stumbling in Sobriety, is available on Amazon. It's available at a couple of local bookshops. You've got a book release party coming up, correct?
That is correct. So a couple things to tell you about. If you go into stumblingintosobriety.org and go to the photo galleries, there's a silent auction on there that has some fabulous things you can bid on. You can also donate $20 and you'll get a book and two tickets to the book release party on Sunday, but you have to do that by midnight tonight. And then, like you said, you can just get the book on Amazon if you choose.
Thank you so much. That's Tracy Collins, a local media celebrity for many years, wrote a memoir, Stumbling into Sobriety. You can get it on Amazon, you get it at local bookshops. Thank you so much for coming in, Tracy. It's been wonderful interviewing you and talking about your book a little bit.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests, all of our callers, the show's producer today, Jessica Palumbo. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show's theme composed and performed by Peter Shefchik. If you have questions or comments about First Coast Connect, email us firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And don't forget to join us at 1 p.m. this afternoon for the Florida Roundup. Replay at 8 p.m. tonight for this show. I'm A.G. Gankarski from Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM. Your community, your world. Have a great weekend. Melissa's back on Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.